Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Jody Kretzman, who will be speaking on Rebuilding Our Cities, How Helpers Can Hurt. So let's listen in on Jody Kretzman.
This is a session that is part of an ongoing series of discussions we're having about rebuilding cities. And the focus of these discussions is really about communities, and it's about how people, I think, are under our very noses, and sometimes without our recognizing it, are rethinking what community is and what community power might be in relationship particularly to some of the most difficult and daunting issues of inequality and powerlessness and abandonment and discouragement that we face at this point. I think it's a wonderful idea that you all are sitting on that side of the fireplace this morning, because I've just been to a very long garbology morning, and I've been shoveling compost up there, and I got back to my chalet and there was no water. So it's terrific that I'm over here and you're over there. Let me start out with a word of background and summary, and apologies to those of you who've been with us in some of these discussions. What I'm doing here is partly ruminating out loud and reporting on a wonderfully exciting 4 to 5 year odyssey that we've been on. I work mostly at the Center for Urban Affairs and Policy Research at Northwestern University in Chicago. And a little group of us there, 4 or 5 years ago, got some money to revisit the 25 largest cities in the United States, and to spend time with not people in the mayor's office or the heads of their major departments, which we sometimes do in other contexts, but with people in communities in those cities, and not just any communities, but the neighborhoods in those cities that were most devastated. We got 16 sessions going here. What's going on? Who's bell? I guess it's lunchtime.
Yes.
So we settled in for periods of time to the South Bronx and spent time in South Central Los Angeles and the East Side of Detroit and South and West Sides of Chicago, listening to people, getting to know folks there, and our mission was one that turned out to be incredibly exciting. It was to gather from very unlikely places stories about successes, about what works, about what it is in the most difficult circumstances, from the South Bronx to South Central Los Angeles, was energizing local people. What was it that was bringing them together in new and powerful ways? What was it that was creating some hope, some sense of possibility for their future in those places? And the lessons that we've picked up have helped us to think with those folks about what rebuilding cities might be about for the next couple of decades. And I think it's also helped us think about how building communities in places that are not quite so desperate as the South Bronx and South Central Los Angeles might also be rethought in this period of time. I think, again, the fundamental lesson that we've learned and we've tried to distill and think about with people across the country is the way in which folks are redefining their reality away from what in some of their eyes, I think, and now increasingly in my own, had become a kind of prison. Everybody we talked to in desperate situations certainly talked to us about the economic difficulties that their communities faced, and the way in which the job market had changed, and the way in which it was more and more difficult for people to get into the economy in any kind of meaningful way. Everybody also talked to us about the kind of abandonment that major institutions had left their neighborhoods, that hospitals are gone, that lots of churches have closed, that public sector institutions are not nearly as effective as they once were, schools and parks and libraries and police and fire and so on. even Garbo. But what they told us, I think, over and over again, which has become for us the key to rebuilding communities and cities, is that the probably the major obstacle, some of them talked about it as a prison, the major obstacle to their rethinking who they are and rebuilding places like the South Bronx was, in fact, the set of ideas that people had constructed about who they were there, about who I am if I live in the South Bronx, or who I am if I live in public housing, or who I am if I live in South Central Los Angeles. And who I am is a whole series of things that it turns out are unremittingly negative. That I am a collection of problems and needs and deficiencies and emptinesses, which are virtually unending and absolutely impossible to meet or satiate or fill up. And the quickest way to sort of display this, I think, that we found is this little map. This is a neighborhood needs map. Can you see it over there? It's a map that's not of any particular neighborhood, but it's a map that appears in people's heads, in our heads, I think. We could go through an exercise we did the other day. If I say South Bronx to you, or if I say public housing to you, what comes to your mind? And my guess is it's something like this. It's unemployment and crime and broken families and mental disability and welfare recipients and lead poisoning and dropouts and illiteracy, right? It's a mental map. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we're trying to dispel in our stepfamily class mm-hmm. is avoiding the term broken families mm-hmm. and using different words.
Absolutely.
For
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But this is a needs map. I mean, this is you could put broken families at the top, for instance, of a grant application to the United Way mm-hmm. and get it funded, right? That's another way to think about this map.
Right.
What attracts money? And this is a set of ideas about people and families and blocks and whole neighborhoods that is unremittingly about their emptiness and about their deficiencies and about their brokenness. And what I think, just to follow on what you're saying, Barbara, what seems to me exactly right, what I think we've rediscovered in collecting these success stories is the basic common sense historic truth that every community that is ever rebuilt is always built on the fullness of people who also have problems, who are also empty, like all of us, right? Who are also deficient, who also need help. But first of all, it is the focus on the fullness. So if we had a glass here and it was half full and half empty, I would say it's like all of us. We're all half full and we're all half empty. And that the question always is not, is it half full or half empty, but which half do you focus on? Do you start with the fullness or do you start with the emptiness? And what we're arguing here is that we now have 30 years of public policy that targets communities and whole populations based on their emptiness, based on what they don't have, what their warts are, what their sicknesses are, how broken they are. Unremitting 30 years of public policy and powerful, powerful now institutional interests, which are built up around the idea that whole populations of individuals and whole communities are nothing but emptiness, are nothing but problematic. So that what we have found over and over again, Barbara, is what you were pointing to, I think, is that people who are thinking about building communities have thrown that map out and have said, that's not a map we drew about ourselves. That's a map somebody else drew about us. By the way, universities draw that map. My own places draw that map. Much of what social science is, I think, is the quantification of misery. How it is you understand problems in ever more quantified and therefore sort of these days religiously significant ways. This is liturgy. The modern liturgy is all about numbers, I think. Yeah.
Isn't part of the impetus behind a lot of the gang activity in the inner cities, just can be seen as an effort to deal with that empty definition, to give a positive connotation for what it means to be as part of the neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely. If you think that this is your reality, I mean, probably the most tragic thing about this, we've said before here in these sessions, is that although local neighborhood folks don't draw this map about themselves, sometimes they start to believe it about themselves. You know, and that is for me now one of the major explanations of hopelessness. So if I'm a kid on a street corner, or if I'm Bill Clinton in the White House, and this is the reality that I think is out there, I understand that this reality is an endless sponge for resources. It's a deep and ever-deepening hole down which I can pour resources. If I'm a kid on the street corner, I not only want to get together with my peers, but I also want to grab the short-term, clear money, dope deal, if that's what's out there, because there's no future here. This is not a picture of a community that has a future. It's not a picture of a place where I can imagine myself as an 18-year-old, now 20 years down the pike, somehow being a contributing member of a community. So this is about hopelessness. And at most, it is a map to policies which are focused on individuals and the survival of individuals in the absence of working economies and working communities. I'm sort of summarizing some of the stuff we've done in some past days here, but it is an important kind of base to draw. This is also, just to say one other thing about this map does determine where our money goes. This is a map that shows what public policy is about in terms of allocation of resources. I mentioned the other day a study we did in Chicago about now 7 or 8 years ago, where we tried to figure out how many public dollars were coming into Chicago targeted to poor people in some way, to help poor people. Right? And we were pretty conservative in what we counted. We didn't count a lot of education dollars, we didn't count a lot of criminal justice dollars. What we got, though, was a figure that was about $25,000 per family of four. $25,000 per family of four public dollars coming into Chicago targeted to poor people, per poor family of four, right? $25,000. This is about 8 years ago. That's not the Ritz, but it's not deep poverty either. At that point, it was a little over twice what the poverty rate was for a family of four. But you know the kicker, right? I mean, the kicker is that about $7,000 of that $25,000 actually goes into the pockets of poor people so that they have the wherewithal to make choices in the market. The other $18,000 goes to people whose jobs are defined by this map, whose jobs are defined as helpers, as people providing services, as people, and about 50% of it went to the medical profession, targeted to poor people. So this is a map that has said the problem with poor people is that they need more and more and more services. Some of our more cynical friends in the low-income communities in the west side of Chicago now say, what that study proved was that it takes one good poor community to support two good middle class communities. If we want to know how welfare works, that's the way it works.
When they came up with this map, was there any particular design of the map? Was crime the core, and that's why it's right in the middle?
No, it wasn't that way, but let me just show you how, when we did this, one thought at least that we had about it from Harvard. Was that
people in communities have been constructing a new map where we found these success stories, and we've now got hundreds of them collected in a little book here. Unfortunately, it's been sold out of its first printing. It's only been out for a couple of months, and it's gone a little hotter than we thought. What we found, though, in communities across the country is that people have thrown that map out and constructed their own map. That's where some of our other tax money goes. That people in communities, in fact, have rediscovered something like this old wisdom, that all communities are built, first of all, on the strengths and the capacities and the gifts of the individuals in those neighborhoods. and then on the mobilizing power of the citizens' associations, including, importantly, the churches, and then on the power of local institutions, when those local institutions can be recaptured for community-building purposes. So we're talking here about three major community building blocks: individuals, citizens' associations, and institutions. And what I want to do mainly today is to think about help. And not help that hurts, but help that actually helps in relationship to the associational and institutional life of our communities. But Barbara, just to go back for a second, when we were playing with these maps, one of the things we did was to put the needs map on top of the assets map and say, you could sort of think about the solutions locally defined in communities to the problems identified on the needs map, if you did this sort of simple-minded overlay, right? So that you would have schools in truancy and libraries in illiteracy and community colleges dealing with job training and dropouts and so on. Something to do with hospitals and parks and gangs. There's some sense in which, in other words, there is a match between what local communities can do to solve problems and the problems facing local communities. There you go, okay. This is not a perfect match. okay, that's all sort of by way of introduction. Are you following where we're going here? In one sense, I think what we've discovered is that in the 1960s and 70s, we were always thinking, when we thought about low-income communities and cities, we were always thinking about large-scale solutions with mega dollars out of the public sector poured into somehow turning everything around at once. When we ran into the very deep recession of 1973 and 1974, and then a series of shallower recessions, but nonetheless real displacement in terms of jobs and the economy, and government money got squished, and then we came into the Reagan and Bush years. By that time, people's idea, that the idea that the public sector, that government, number one, was capable of solving deep-seated problems that involved poverty and a changing economy and race and changing family and other demographic kinds of development. The idea that government could do much that was helpful, that there was something that could be done in Washington and on Capitol Hill that somehow would respond to what was going on in local communities and cities, that idea began to exhaust itself in a variety of ways. Clearly a lot of good was done by the public sector involvement in the 60s and 70s, but it hit limits. And of course, the other limits it hit were the resource limits. There simply was not the ever-expanding public purse on which a lot of the designs of programs in the 1960s and 70s were based. So up against limits, we hit the 80s. And I think what's happened in the 80s is that people, the phrase I keep using, is under the radar, under the Brokaw news, under the New York Times headlines, in communities all across the United States, folks have begun to look around and say, you know, City Hall doesn't have any resources anymore. A new Ford plant is not about to come in here and give us all jobs back. All we've got is what we see around us. All we've got is each other. And all we've got is the buildings and the land that we live on here. What do we do? How, in fact, then do we reinvent community? And that's the process then that we've been looking at. And it's not a process that has been publicly acknowledged yet. So we're trying to be part of a discussion nationally, which I think is picking up, that has to do with how you reimagine cities being rebuilt from the bottom up, or as we put it, from the inside out, where folks in fact reinvent both an economy and a going community life. And then how is it that bigger institutions, governments, churches even, the private sector, could support that activity rather than squish it, rather than squelching and over-defining initiative? How could that initiative be helped? And that's a little bit of what I'd like to think with you about. for the next couple of minutes. Are we on board now? You know, sort of where we're going. I want to have some discussion of toward the end of the hour here of your own experience, either as helpers or as helpees, because I think one of the things we've been forced to do is to rethink the terrific dilemmas of helping and how it is that the need to be needed can begin to build into a kind of need to dominate, a kind of over-control of the definitions of people's lives, a kind of really sort of imperial relationship to folks. But I want to back into that and do something that's a little bit less immediately experiential for just a second. This assets map noted that yesterday we started with the gifts of individuals. And the premise there, the premises that we worked with for a little bit yesterday had to do with two simple ideas. One is that where the gifts of individuals are being mobilized for community building purposes, two assumptions work. One is that everybody in the community is gifted. Everybody in the community is gifted. Even people who are primarily defined by their deficiencies or by their emptiness. And the second premise was, that we played with yesterday, is what community building is about is making sure that every gift is given. That is, a gift is not a gift unless it's given. I have a friend who collects stuff from catalogs, who buys things from catalogs. And he does it in order to be able to have his gifts ready for Christmas, right? And so what he does is he stacks it up in a closet. And his grown son came into his house just last year in about August. And he went into a closet and he went back to his father and he said, "Dad, you have a closet full of junk?" And my friend said, "No, that's not junk. Those are gifts." And his son said, "No, they're not gifts. That's junk. Gifts aren't gifts until they're given. It is the giving that makes junk into gifts, right?" So that the function of community, the function of community is always to call forth the gifts of the people and to figure out how to mobilize them. Now, who does that? But that's where we were yesterday. We were thinking about the gifts of individuals. And we were beginning to think then about who, about what the tools are that makes those gifts givable. Let me be very simple-minded about it. Do a quick distinction here. I think I've said before that when we're drawing things these days, it seems simple and somehow meaningful to draw communities as circles and institutions as triangles or pyramids for obvious reasons, I think, if you think about it, right? I want to think then about the relationship between institutions and associations in terms of helping and in terms of building community. What I now think is going on in our culture and in lots of advanced industrial societies is that most people think about reality and experience it day to day as if all of life, it's not very dark, not much darker. Can you see this? I'm just drawing a big triangle here. That all of life is about individuals. David, I'm no better artist than you are. Who are living in sets of institutions. That our lives are basically about how individuals and big systems interact. Whether the big systems are churches, or schools, or human service delivery systems, or places of employment, that most of our life is about big systems and individuals. And that what that leaves out, or at least minimizes, is the possibility that there are circles around, that there are places where communities still intersect with people's daily lives. For most of the last 40 years, we have assumed that what social policy is about is constructing ever larger and more efficient systems to solve the problems of individuals. And so ever more segments of our lives as individuals get defined as problematic. 15 years ago, the first grievance counselor was given a master's degree at the University of Minnesota. Think about for just a second the centuries of life in all of human history where grief at the death of a loved one was something that would be handled in a circle, in a family, with friends. Folks would gather different kinds of traditions. They'd tell stories. They'd maybe have a meal or a Eucharist. Maybe there would be some sort of ritual involved. But all of a sudden now, there's something about our culture which has decided that we need professionally trained people who are part of a larger human service delivery system to intervene in Aunt Tilly's life when Aunt Minnie dies. Because there isn't anybody else, we think. I'm trying to make you think about whether or not we've been experiencing, again under the radar, and sort of without much thought, a kind of intrusion that has been continual and escalating into the capacities of communities to solve their own problems, into the capacities of families to care for each other. And whether or not we may be, in the late 20th century, coming up against the limits of that way of thinking about communities. You see? Is it possible? I'm now really convinced that part of what we're seeing is an attempt in local communities, particularly those that have been abandoned in terms of any effective activity by most mainstream institutions, to sort of re-equalize, if you will, the relationship between community-based problem-solving capacities and institutional problem-solving capacities. But just think about these two things for a minute. Everybody here is part of an institution, I take it, probably, right? We've got one foot clearly planted in an institutional church, a university in my case, a place of employment.
Hospital. I was at the hospital.
In a hospital? What other institutions are here? Another university?
Corporations.
Library? Yes. Corporation? If you think about your experience on the one hand, in family and what we call sometimes citizens' associations, or on the other hand, in institutions, do they feel different? When we started thinking about, you know, you do some simple kinds of comparisons and contrasts here. There's a wonderful old European sociologist named Tunis who used to talk about Gemeinschaft as Gesellschaft, and there's a sort of community way of being, an institutional way of being. This is a sort of revisit of some of that work, and I think it works now in a different way in our modern cities. If you think about institutions, they tend to be hierarchical. Information flows down. Think about communities or citizens' associations. It's mostly information that flows in a circle. It's more democratic. It's flatter, right? Institutions tend to be formal. Associations and communities tend to be informal. Participation in institutions tends to be mandated. You got to be there. And usually, you get paid for being there. As a matter of fact, if we make a basic sort of distinction between what's an institution, institutions are places where people get paid to do the work. And associations are places where people come together on a voluntary basis to do the work, right? So associations and communities are places that have a voluntary aspect to them. In institutions, you function best if you've got everybody looking alike. Interchangeable parts. It's one kind of definition of bureaucracy. Communities are places that value uniqueness, individuality. People are, in fact, individuals in communities. Face-to-face kinds of relationships are important. Institutions tend to be things that are awfully good at producing a whole lot of the same thing. Forts, or Boeing aircraft, or fifth graders, or seminarians, seminary graduates. Institutions of the kind we have in our lives today, in fact, grew up to produce a whole lot of the same thing on an assembly line. They're structured to do forts. Now, one of the questions then we're raising is, have we hit the limits of what it is that something that's good at producing forts can do when you think about something called human services? Is there something about the uniqueness of human beings, which means that everything being the same is somehow not the best way to meet human needs? Is there a way of thinking then about revivifying the community way of being? A couple other distinctions. Institutions tend to know things by doing things like studies and surveys. And they're surer about things when they're all quantified. Okay? Communities and associations tend to know things by exchanging stories. Okay? If you think about the language of institutions are always aiming toward a language that is more abstract, more objective, and the language of community is always more quirky, more committed, more colloquial, right? More unique to the particular community. So the question is, of these two tools, how can we decide what one is good for and what the other is good for? And how can we decide what it is that we've asked this one to do, the institutional tool, that it's not appropriate to do? You see? Isn't there stuff on the block level, in the family, about youngsters, about older folks, about community safety, about community language, history, about norms, about values, about rituals, about celebrations, that this kind of structure can't do? I don't want to be heard here as being anti-institutional, because it's clear to me, as I'm sure it is to you all, that when you hop on an airplane, if that's the way you're getting out of here, when I hop on an airplane to go back to Chicago, I want that airplane to be part of this system, institution, world. I don't want people to gather in the cockpit and have a little meeting about which button to push. I want to make sure that the Boeing came off exactly the same as all the other Boeings that came off, and that the pilot has a routine that tells him exactly, or her exactly, what to push. On the other hand, I'm not sure I want Boeing in the middle of a community building process. I think Boeing produces terrific airplanes. I think families and extended families and blocks and churches and cultural groups and block clubs, citizens associations of all kinds, are the tool that is undervalued and underused to rebuild communities. So a good part of the hundreds of success stories that we're finding have to do with the process that people are rediscovering when, in fact, the institutions that were to solve their problems have backed off or become ineffective. And the community building process, which is always about rebuilding relationships, has been kicked into gear. One final thing, and then I really want to get into some discussion with you about this. The historical way to think about this, or a historical way to think about the atrophying of community capacity to care, is on the one hand the ever-growing domination and power of institutional answers to problems. But on the other hand, the slow disintegration, which we feel in our church every day, of the inherited community, of the sort of fish in water community. I mean, a lot of what I think the church is going through and mainline Protestantism is going through these days is clearly a kind of rite of passage between an old way of being where the community you grew up in is one you inherited. And it was often ethnic in character. And with that came a whole series of assumptions about how people acted, and what worship was like, and what a congregation was like, and what you ate, and how you dressed, and what your affect was, and all of that stuff. My father's generation swam in that like fish in water. In my own case, in the German community, German Lutheranism. The church today is in a position, and I think it's both frightening and exciting, where none of that inherited stuff can be taken for granted, where it's bursting apart in all kinds of ways. And we're therefore, if we're interested still in the power of local community and associational life to solve problems, we for the first time have to be proactive, absolutely self-conscious community builders, because we don't inherit it. We don't inherit it. I was trained as an Olinsky community organizer almost 30 years ago now in Chicago. And the way Olinsky thought about organizing a community was you go in and you find natural leaders and you find those leaders who are leaders of all of the existing associations and institutions in the neighborhood, and you bring them together, and then you can do something powerful to the banks and to the city halls out there that are defining your life, right? That's changed. You can't go into a community anymore and find all of that inherited stuff in place. So Olinsky used to say, you know, you could get about 1% of the people in a neighborhood as long as they were all the heads of the right inherited associations and institutions, and you would have the neighborhood. Not true any longer. Not true any longer. So what in fact needs to be done now, if we're still interested in the community capacity to solve problems, is that we all need to be incredibly self-conscious and increasingly skilled community builders. And that's about rebuilding relationships among individuals, citizens associations, and local institutions, first of all. So I guess the last thing I want to say about the reports that we've got from across the country is that we have run into some absolutely astonishing relationship builders. People who understand at a variety of levels, from the sort of cold economic set of relationships to the most sort of humane and caring kinds of relationships, how it is you disengage from the expectation that institutions and professionals can solve your problems and re-engage with each other to both care more and begin to project some hope into the future. Helpers that hurt are most often people who are stuck in institutional dimensions, institutional definitions of who they are. And almost all of their direction comes from a set of ideas about a professional helper, which is not often connected with the way in which people are experiencing lives
who are on the sort of healthy end of the relationship. It's a struggle for people who have been trained as helpers in institutions to move over here and to begin to revalue what it is communities can do. Because part of what it means for helpers in big helping institutions is that the major job is to work yourself out of a job. That you're about rethinking who you are in relationship to people in a way that you weren't taught in graduate school. And that's a real challenge. It's also a challenge, I think, for pastors, Carolyn, who are often, apart from word and sacrament ministry, taught that their other most important role is to spot needs and respond to them. So is it possible to rescue some of us from this institutional setting, move us into a community setting, which means that we become gift finders and relationship builders? That would be a challenge that would be sort of fun to take on. Let me stop there and see where we are in this. Come on in, Mike.
Yeah, historically, hasn't one of the problems been that when we've built communities, that very often what we've done then is turn them into institutions and move those natural community helpers out of that natural kind of pattern into the institutional pattern, and so have isolated them and in a sense kind of co-opted them.
Yeah, I think that's one of the paths that can happen. I'm not sure it's the only path that can happen. I think when that happens, there's always stuff that's bubbling up underneath it, too, you know? But we would tend to follow the trajectory of a group that had institutionalized itself, that had gotten big enough, visible enough to begin to attract dollars and so on, and we would sort of then not look back and say, what's under there, right? And I reread last year, when we were thinking about this stuff with community folks across the country, I went back and reread De Tocqueville, which is still just a wonderful book to think about in terms of what we've got to work with in the United States. A book that most of you know, Democracy in America, right? And it's the report of a young French count. I think he was 24 at the time he visited the United States in the early 1830s. And he wrote this report. And the report was to the nobles in Europe about what he had found in this new democracy. And he was just astonished. And one of the things that astonished him most was the discovery, he was the one that named associations, right? He was the one that first called these groups associations. And he said, what's astonishing about life in the United States is that there are these little groups all over the place. And they were neither elected nor appointed. Nobody, you know, they're self-appointed groups, these little associations. And he says they do three things that we would never think of doing in Europe. He says in Europe we think about elections as the way to deal with the problem of entrenched power in the nobility, and that's what democracy is. He says in the New World they're going much farther, because these groups have three outrageous ideas. They think that even though they're not elected or appointed, they can come together, ordinary citizens, and define a problem. And then secondly, he said, they actually think that they can get together and define a solution to the problem. And third, he said, then they have the audacious idea that they could follow their own advice and actually solve the problem themselves, never thinking about a government. There's a sense in which, and it's in Jefferson someplace too, that the act of election, which we sometimes think of as the centerpiece of democracy, is really better thought of as the act of giving away power. You've decided by your vote to whom you will cede your power as a citizen. So I think what we're seeing in communities that have been completely abandoned is the rediscovery of a deeper understanding of what citizenship is. Citizenship is not giving away power, but taking unto the community the problem-solving process. and doing it, at least insofar as it's possible to do it, with the tools at hand. I think there is a natural association to institution kind of movement. At least that's one natural movement. But every time that happens, new stuff grows up underneath. Is that true in your experience? Is that? And sometimes I think we are so sort of captured by institutional life that the associational life becomes a little bit difficult to uncover. I told the story the other day of a neighborhood. We've done a lot of work in Logan Square in Chicago, where the neighborhood group there wanted to get more deeply involved with all of the associational life in this neighborhood of 40,000 people. And we worked out this little experiment. We lent them a graduate student for 3 weeks. And this graduate student was a Japanese-American, bright young woman. But her first language was Japanese and her second language was English. And this was a neighborhood whose predominant language was Spanish and second language was Polish, right? So Kathy went into this neighborhood, and her assignment was, in 3 weeks, just using the phone book and the phone and interviews, make a list of as many citizens associations as you can make in this neighborhood. And she spent 3 weeks there talking to people, and she got a list of over 1,300 citizens associations in this single neighborhood. It's a sort of low-income neighborhood, working-class kind of neighborhood in Chicago. And we showed that list to the leaders of the neighborhood group, who had all been there all their lives, deeply rooted, knew a lot of stuff, and two-thirds of the associations on that list were new to them. They didn't know about it. The lesson always is, at least when we're working in communities, is there's always more there than you think in terms of citizens' associations. We just need to look at it again. Yeah, Judy?
One thing that I think is a great value of associations is that the institutions in most communities never cooperate with each other and never talk to each other.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And so if you have this problem here at the center of, and all these institutions are kind of missing the problem, they're all kind of trying to solve it, but they kind of sweep out and come back, but they never talk to each other and bring their power together to solve that problem, so they all kind of miss it. Mm-hmm. And what citizens associations can do is to make those institutions communicate with one another and cooperate with one another to
yes.
solve the problems.
Yeah, and surround them, and in fact recapture them. I mean, a whole other set of stories can be told about how it is you take institutions. A lot of our neighborhoods and cities are filled with institutions that are absolutely present physically but unresponsive in any other way, right? I mean, we have 552 schools in Chicago, but those schools up until a few years ago might as well have been located, for all the good they were doing in terms of community building, they might as well have been located in Milwaukee. I mean, there were just absolutely no connection between local community building agendas and those local schools. They have now been, though, surrounded by citizens. Each of them now has a local school board. And the citizens have taken over each of those schools. There are now 552 separate stories, each of which is about a unique set of relationships between a community and a school that's getting redefined because citizens and their associations have recaptured that institution. I think churches, you can tell a church when you walk into it in a neighborhood that has broken the walls down between what it is as an outpost of a larger institution and what the community around it is about. You can just tell it.
Church and the city government and the YMCA is getting all of those various groups to institutions to combine to solve problems.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's absolutely right.
That same kind of thing happened in some of the redlining. In terms of local associations coming together to impact the financial institutions, mm-hmm. stop draining away resources.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think what we're seeing sort of reemerge here at the community level is a whole way of repositioning local communities with respect to outside resources. And there are some models in our past in the last couple of decades But I think we're thinking with people who are tired of a charity posture, of saying, look at all the stuff we don't have. Help us, church office. Help us, city hall. Help us, HUD. And the game is always to paint the needs in ever more graphic terms, right? So that the money flows. And that's the dance we've created for low-income people and communities. What's exciting is to see more and more communities who have said, we may not have everything we need here, but everything we've got, we've found. And we've connected it with each other. And it's all now convened in a way that this neighborhood knows where it's going. I mean, that's something, if you think about each institution or set of associations in the neighborhood, these are all actual sort of stories, as the center of a set of relationships. This is churches relating to schools, business associations, police, daycare centers, community development corporations, colleges, social, et cetera. And you think about what it would be like for each institution in the neighborhood to redefine itself partly as a community building institution. And part of what that redefinition would mean would be to say, what would life be like at the center of a whole set of relationships that were about mutually beneficial problem-solving activity, concrete relationships, not sort of abstract, send Christmas card relationships, but how can we work together with the local faith and so on? And if the churches did that, and the local libraries did that, and the local parks did that, and the local businesses did that, and on and on and on, you would get a mess. You would get a picture of an overlapping, ever-deepening web of relationships that were about local problem-solving that looked as messy as this because that's what democratic problem-solving looks like. Pretty messy. Not as controllable as the old institutional way of solving problems. Not as predictable, but awfully powerful. And when you get this kind of a neighborhood, and you can sort of feel it when it's happening in a neighborhood, then they no longer go to the United Way or to the ELCA headquarters or the City Hall with their hands out. They go this way and say, this is about now investment and partnership, not charity. We do have some things that we could use from you, ELCA headquarters or City Hall in Los Angeles or whatever. But the way we'd like to use it is in partnership. We'd like to sit at a table where we're more or less equal. And we'd like to figure out with you how it is that you might invest in our community and get a return. That's a different kind of relationship with a health plan. And it's more like what, in fact, banks are learning in the post-redlining era. Banks are now learning they can actually make a buck doing mortgage lending in low-income neighborhoods. So at first they had to be forced to look at it again, and now at least some smart banks are saying, yeah, we can do that, we can make a little money doing it too. Back to this helping question for just a second. Has the helping relationship ever for you all been problematic? I mean, either on the helpy or helper end. Can we think about that out loud for a minute in terms of how that is a problematic relationship? I'm not sure we sort of surface that enough sometimes.
The church is one of the missions often, and domineering and dominating. Trying to get, for many years, churches have been trying to get away from that and be in the partnership. It takes a whole new way of thinking that we're sending missionaries out. There's so many people, I want to know why are we sending people out rather than waiting to be invited to come. And that's also a big conflict that we live in the third world, where we have different ideas about how to go about mission. But how are you going to help people?
some of the most exciting discussions I've been in have been sort of exchanges between people who are doing community building in so-called third world settings and people who are doing community building in North America. And it's astonishing what it is can be learned. From my point of view, the learning always goes much more toward us in the United States from folks, and particularly the ones that I've been most involved with in Central America, Mexico, Latin America. Most folks working in communities, for example, in Mexico City, don't have the illusion that if they wait long enough, some large church agency or the government or somebody will figure out a way to take care of them. And so they've invented a whole series of ways to rebuild communities. Post-earthquake kind of operations are just astounding in a place like Mexico City. Yeah, the mission, the whole mission relationship is clearly one. How about others? Where is helping, either on a personal level or on an institutional level, at least a problematic kind of stuff? Carol?
Well, I get, one of my frustrations is the number of calls that I get to help individuals who assume that the church is there as a personal loan bank, and I mean, all of these kinds of things that I think, well, boy, you know, if I don't know where they get that notion, but I was thinking, you know, that we probably wouldn't loan that kind of money that they're asking for to, even to our members,
yeah.
Let alone to a stranger, you know, so it's really difficult to, we might loan it to our members, but it's very problematic, but we certainly wouldn't loan it to this guy standing there. And I don't know whether that's because they think that the church is such a sucker, or whether if they come at the right times that they'll be sure to, they'll be sure that the congregation will eventually say, oh, I want to deal with this guy, so give him to the pastor, or what. But I bet I deal with five or six people per month that catch me at the most strange times. I mean, immediately after the service while I'm greeting people, or just as I'm, you know, I've learned not to be there on Friday afternoons because that's a great hit time, because the institutions are all closed and they can't get any money, and that's their excuse.
Yeah.
So it makes you feel terrible, but it's also very angering that the church has become kind of the place for these folks to hit. So then you think, well, then how can I be of help? So you end up doing fundraisers that benefit institutions that deal with these folks. Well, I'm not so sure that's, I mean, I think that's good for our people to be involved in seeing. I mean, we just did a fundraiser for a combination of Habitat for Humanity and the West Side Fairview Housing Council, which is a very interesting combination. But and there were some interesting things we learned about that. The Fair Housing Council was surprised at our hospitality. They didn't think the church was the most of the people that were meeting with us to plan the event were surprised. And some of their questions were about whether Habitat for Humanity ever benefited anybody except Christians. So that was a nice exchange of information. I think it's really difficult to have the church, to hold in front of the church a vision of being a community that helps others and not just itself, and this trap of just feeding, you know, there's never an end to the needs.
Yeah. You know, it doesn't seem to me that there's a need to throw out entirely the identification of the church with charity.
Yeah.
And as a place where, when all is lost, there's still some possibility to go and find something that one needs. I think the challenge for congregations is to figure out how to take a charity relationship. The first problem is that most charity doesn't have relationship built into it at all. It's the act of giving with no relationship, really, right? But how to begin to build relationship out of a charity act, right? And then how to figure out in that relationship how to find and mobilize, to use the language we've been using this week, the gifts of